Thanks be to God indeed. This is an odd story. It comes right in the middle of the Gospels. It seems to interrupt the very flow of the story. And it's an odd occurrence. Jesus appears with two guys that have been gone from this earth for hundreds of years. Remember, there's a 400-year void in the voice of the prophets between the last prophet and Jesus. There's silence. Maybe the last prophet and John the Baptist, if you want to get technical about how things went. But Jesus has been teaching and preaching and performing miracles of all kinds in the presence of the disciples. There were all kinds of questions about who Jesus was. In the previous chapter, in Mark 8, it gives a description of a conversation between Jesus and Peter where Jesus asks about, ask them to say who he is. I'm going to read it to you. Mark 8, starting in verse 27. Mark was here just a minute ago. 8 and 27. Peter's declaration about Jesus. Jesus and his disciples left Galilee and went up to the villages near Caesarea Philippi. As they were walking along, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" "Well," they replied, "some say John the Baptist. Some say Elijah. And others say you are one of the other prophets." Then he asked them, "But who do you say I am?" And Peter replied, "You are the Messiah." But Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. Then in the end of chapter 8, Jesus predicts his own death and resurrection for the first time. Right? So 6 days later is 6 days after Peter's confession that Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus leads Peter, James, and John up the mountain, the same three disciples that Jesus will later take with him to the Garden of Gethsemane. Once they had reached the top of the mountain where the four were alone together, Jesus is transfigured before their eyes. Jesus' clothing became dazzling white, whiter than anyone could possibly bleach them. The brightness, I imagine, is that of the sun shining on new fallen snow. Not hard for us to imagine in this weather, right? So I imagine the disciples shielding their eyes and turning their heads away from the brightness that they are seeing, like this, shielding their eyes. My daughter is an optometrist, and she made me get these prescription sunglasses because the sun is damaging to your eyes that way. This is bright like that they're experiencing. And Jesus shines so brightly before them, and they're standing looking through their fingers, trying to see what it is that is happening before them. And in the midst of this, they see these three figures standing together now. And I'm going to switch back because while these are polarized and I can read, it's way easier with these other ones, right? So in this kind of light, I often need sunglasses more in the winter than I do in the summer. In the summer, you're looking at grass and concrete and asphalt and darker colors. It's not quite so hard on the eyes, except perhaps you get out on the lake or near a lake and you're fishing, or you're out on the pontoon, or you're doing whatever you're doing. And the sun off the water is pretty bright, pretty hard on the eyeballs. But this is the kind of brightness that I imagine Peter, James, and John experiencing. When their eyes adjust and they can see a little more clearly, they notice that Jesus is not alone. He is standing before them with Moses and Elijah. The three appear to be having a conversation. The gospel account of this event says, "Then Peter says to Jesus." But as I try to place myself in this story, I don't imagine this question from Peter came very quickly. There was so much for the three disciples to process. Who were these guys Jesus was talking with? Where did they come from? The Zondervan commentary I read said that while tradition has Mount Tabor as the mountain that they ascended, with its highest point at 1,800 feet, Because they were in Caesarea Philippi, it's more likely that they ascended Mount Hermon, which reaches over 9,000 feet at its peak. How many have hiked over 9,000 feet at elevation? Right? Yeah. It's way up there. The air is thin. Right? If you don't stay hydrated in those elevations, you can get a little loony. Right? In those places. Now, I don't think that's what's happening here, but the point is that it's a long way up there, and Jesus took these three disciples with him so that they could, and they went alone, so they could get away. And at 9,000 feet, the population's not very dense, and all of a sudden there are two other people there with them. Right? There's a lot happening that has to be processed before Peter can utter can say anything to Jesus. And Peter has to sort through his childhood education in Hebrew school to even figure out who these guys are. Both Moses and Elijah are thought to have ascended to God without experiencing death. Elijah ascended in a whirlwind into heaven in 2 Kings chapter 2, starting in verse 9. When they came to the other side, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me what I can do for you before I am taken away." And Elisha replied, "Please let me inherit a double share of your spirit and become your successor." You have asked a difficult thing," Elijah replied. "If you see me when I am taken from you, then you will get your request. But if not, then you won't." As they were walking along and talking, suddenly a chariot of fire appeared, drawn by horses of fire. It drove between the two men, separating them, and Elijah was carried by a whirlwind into heaven. Elisha saw, and he cried out, my father, I see the chariots and the charioteers of Israel." And Elijah is swept up into heaven without death. In Deuteronomy 34, there is a description of Moses' death, but no one knows his burial place to this day, it says in verse 6. A figure as prominent as Moses would most certainly have had a tomb marked for posterity. As we will learn in a moment, that is what the Israelites did. Everywhere something important happened, they erected a monument. Right? Moses' death and burial would have been a really big deal. There is nothing to mark his grave. No one knows where it is. One can only posit that they must not have had a body to bury. I often say at a gravesite that we are here not to mark someone's death, but we place a stone to remember that someone has lived. Moses' life was so significant to the Hebrew people. It is thought that there is no way that the Israelites could have had a body to bury and left the grave unmarked. So the conclusion is that Moses also ascended without experiencing physical death. There's another point of significance that links Moses with this transfiguration story, and that is the appearance of Moses, face when he descends from Mount Sinai with the tablets on which God has instructed him to inscribe the commandments. In Exodus 34, verses 29, it says, "When Moses came down from Mount Sinai carrying the two stone tablets inscribed with the terms of the covenant, he wasn't aware that his face had become radiant because he had spoken to the Lord. So when Aaron and the people of Israel saw the radiance of Moses' face, they were afraid to come near him. But Moses called out to them and asked Aaron and all the leaders of the community to come over, and he talked with them. Then all the people of Israel approached him, and Moses gave them all the instructions that the Lord had given him on Mount Sinai. When Moses finished speaking with them, he covered his face with a veil. But every time he went to the Holy of Holies, he took off the veil, and he would come out appearing again with a glow in his face." So Peter, having to put all of this together, understands that Jesus is standing on the top of the mountain together with Moses and Elijah, century-old figures, and he is awestruck. So the way the scripture reads, it seems like he just utters this question out of nowhere, but I can imagine that it took a minute for him to figure out what was happening. I don't know how many of you remember history real well from your school days, but I don't. I would have to do some homework. But he's able to recall who these people might be, and when he realizes that Jesus is standing together with Moses and Elijah, he is awestruck, terrified. And he says, "Rabbi, it's good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters. Something important happened. Let's build something. Let's put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." And then the next verse says, he did not know what to say. They were so frightened. You think? Sounds frightening to me. And here's this reference that I alluded to, with the notion that the Jewish tradition was to build a monument or a temple or an altar in places where significant things happened. For Peter, the only thing that he could think to say was, "Let's build something." Peter's trance is broken as a cloud envelops them, and a voice from heaven says, "This is my son, my beloved. Listen to him." Listen to him. The disciples had been listening to Jesus for years. They trusted him enough to ascend a 9,000-foot mountain with him on that day. It may have taken him a couple of days. Peter had already answered Jesus' question about who he thought he was by telling him that he was the Messiah. Why would they need to have this experience of confirmation? Didn't Jesus believe them? A few weeks ago, Roshan and I were asked to, were invited by our youngest daughter, who is taking American Sign Language at LCC, to observe a class that is called voicing. In voicing, the students are watching sign language on a video screen, and they have to interpret from ASL back to English and tell the story that they're seeing on the screen. Observers are invited into the class so that they can confirm the things that they learn as the story is translated from sign language. And Roshan and I don't know sign language, so we had to rely on the translators to tell us the story. Well, as the instructor was asking the students to tell their parts of the story in pieces, she would go around the room, and if the student wasn't convincing enough in their answer, she would point to us and say, "Do you believe them? Do you believe her?" So it went something like this. So she would point to the student, and the student would say, "The car drove into the driveway and stopped by the house." Right? Or the student would say, "The car drove into the driveway and stopped by the house?" And if the student said it that way, the instructor would say, "Do you believe her?" And we'd say, "No." And they'd have to say it again. "The car drove into the driveway and stopped by the house." Right? "The car went around many curves before arriving at the address." That doesn't get it done. So maybe, this confirmation comes because when we read the Gospels, I read them like I always read them. We have to make decisions based on, we don't get to hear inflections in voices. We just have to make decisions about what it says. So maybe when Jesus says, "But who do you say I am?" Peter answered him like this: "You are the Messiah?" Like, "I think I know. You are the Messiah?" Right? As we try to answer the question about this event in the Gospels, which, by the way, is captured in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which makes it really important, one of the questions we have to answer is, why is this so important? And Jesus has just foretold his death and resurrection. There is no way the disciples understand what Jesus is talking about. Just before this trek up the mountain, Peter rebukes Jesus for even talking about his own death. He goes right nose to nose with Jesus and says, "Uh-uh, not on my watch, they're not going to kill you." And Jesus says, "Get behind me, Satan. Like, get out of God's way. And let this happen." So there's no way that they understand completely what is happening. It is clear to Jesus that these guys, even though they say that Jesus is the Messiah, they don't really understand it. So up the mountain they go, and Jesus can reveal his godliness, his holiness, his divinity, his divine nature. The only way to understand the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ is through Christ's divinity. Wednesday is Ash Wednesday, which marks the beginning of Lent, our journey with Jesus to Calvary, the same journey the disciples were about to embark on with Jesus in real time. Our journey to Calvary and then into the garden on the morning of the resurrection. We are privileged to know that the events of Good Friday are not the end of the story, but the disciples didn't have the same advantage. If Peter, James, and John didn't have a clear understanding of who Jesus was, who knows how they would have responded to Jesus' death? Perhaps there would have been a riot or a rebellion that the Roman government would have put down in short order. Christianity would have been wiped out. Perhaps they would have simply fled Jerusalem and Christianity would have died with Jesus. No one left to hold it together. But with an understanding that Jesus was God's Son, divine, holy, and set apart, they were able to do as they were told, staying in Jerusalem, because hope remained. Hope in what? They may not have known. What Jesus meant by saying that he would be raised from the dead, they didn't know, but they did know that if Jesus was God's Son, there was possibility in the mystery that they were experiencing. So they waited. They huddled together in their grief, huddled together in the last place they were together with Jesus, and they waited. 3 days later, Jesus appeared to them just as he said he would. And the meaning of it all begins to take shape. When we experience death, we wait with the same hope, the same anticipation that what Jesus says will be what those we have lost will experience. And the hope that we have that gives us hope for our own experience of death. The Transfiguration provided confirmation for the disciples who, while given instructions not to talk about it while Jesus was still living, gave them something to hold on to while they waited between Good Friday and Easter. I think it does the same for us. An understanding that Jesus is the Christ, that Jesus is both fully human and fully God at the same time, gives us something to hold on to in the waiting. We may identify best with the humanity of Jesus, but it is the divinity that saves us from sin and death. It is the promise that we are raised with Christ that gives us his victory. There is one more thing that the Transfiguration speaks for me before I close. As I think about my own judgment, my own mortality, the Scriptures say that we'll stand before God and we'll answer for everything that we've said, everything that we've done in our lives. And I don't know about you, but that's a bit daunting for me to think about. Everything I've ever done, everything I've ever said. Yikes. But the risen Christ comes with the promise that we will not stand there alone. And for me, it's the transfigured Christ that will meet me there in that holy room with God. As I stand before God in the brightness of Christ's transfigured being, and the holiness fills the room, the lens through which God is looking at everything I've ever done and hearing everything I ever said is the transfigured Christ. Bright, shining, righteousness fills the space, so much so that my sin, my guilt, my shame is blotted out. Then I can stand before the Lord. We heard in the offering time the beginning of the song, I Can Only Imagine, and I can imagine. And if you close your eyes and you imagine standing before the throne of God with Christ at your side and the space so illumined and filled with God's glory that there's not room for your sin in that space. That's the only way I can imagine judgment without dread. I'm actually looking forward to it. I'm ready, but I'm not in a hurry. Right? When he comes, I'll be ready, but I'm not in a big old hurry. I got stuff to do. But like Peter, James, and John, it is the knowledge that Jesus is who he says he is that gives us hope enough to carry us through Lent, through Good Friday to Easter, through our death to our resurrection. And through Christ, we get to live every day as Easter people. People that live with and in the resurrected Christ. Pray with me.